high-ranking former military officials, intelligence officials, and others. And so these women were killed. This Afghan police commander who had fought with U.S. soldiers against the Taliban and against the Haqqani network in his province, and whose house was filled with pictures of him and U.S. soldiers smiling in these pictures, had just been killed. And when the U.S. commandos that raided the house realized that they had killed these women and that the men that they had killed were not, in fact, Taliban, and that what they were doing that night was the most anti-Taliban of things they could have been doing, which was to be having a party with live music celebrating the naming of a child, and men were dancing and playing instruments, and it was this loud, boisterous party, and we have their cell phone video from that night. So they raid this house. These people are killed. Instead of saying, wow, we really messed up, and owning it. And that stuff happens every day in Afghanistan. People are getting killed all the time that have no attachment whatsoever to the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or the Haqqani network. And the U.S. will often just pay them a little bit of money and move on, and it never makes it into the papers. That wouldn't have been out of place. But instead of doing that, they dug the bullets out of the women's bodies. And then they told their commanders that what had happened in the compound that night was a Taliban ambush of this family, and that they had come upon these women who had been killed by the Taliban. And then there were leaks saying that, well, no, this was actually an honor killing, and the women were killed by their own family members. And they put out a press release, and spokespeople made these statements saying that that the U.S. soldiers were essentially heroes that had gone in there and saved everyone else. But then the family members, because they were a prominent family, one of the fathers of the women was the vice dean at Gardez University, who spoke fluent English, started calling reporters and telling people, you know, this is not what NATO is saying. Then a very great reporter named Jerome Starkey actually went down there. He writes for the Times of London and interviewed the family members and did a story saying that this was a NATO raid. He didn't know it was JSOC at the time, that this was a botched NATO raid and that NATO had tried to cover it up. And he told the story of these families. And when Jerome Starkey did this, NATO did something extraordinary. They named him in a press release and said, Jerome Starkey of the Times of London is lying. They actually accused him of lying. And I mean, that could have ended Starkey's career. And Starkey, to his credit, kept pushing and pushing and ended up doing a number of stories and got close to that family. And Rick and I also went to this family and filmed with them. And you see this in our video, and tell the story of what happened to Jerome Starkey as well. So media attention is focused in now on this village and this one family's compound. And eventually, NATO calls up Starkey and they said, we're about to put out a press release. We're going to change our version of events. And they admit that NATO forces had killed these pregnant women and that the men were not Taliban commanders. So the family told me and told Jerome Starkey the same thing, which is that they got a call. And a person they believed was General Stanley McChrystal was going to be coming to visit them. And at the time, McChrystal was the commander of all U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. And they actually were plotting. They wanted to kill General McChrystal. They wanted to stab him to death when he came into their home. And one of the men told me that when they did this to my family, I wanted to put on a suicide vest and blow myself up among the Americans. Remember, these were U.S. allies, and now they're saying, I want a suicide vest, and I want to kill General McChrystal, who was the leader of the war. And an imam at their local mosque said, no, you're not to do that. You're to give him hospitality like our people do, and you're welcome him into your home and hear what he has to say. So they thought that General McChrystal was coming to see them. They called Jerome Starkey. Starkey goes down there with his photographer, Jeremy Kelly, and they're waiting with the family, thinking that McChrystal's going to show up. And up pulls this convoy of vehicles with countless Afghan military officials and some Americans interspersed with them. And in the center of this crowd is a guy with a name tag that says McRaven on it and has three stars on the lapel. And they've brought with them two sheep. And they approached the compound in the very place where the women had been killed and this police commander had been killed. And they offload these sheep, and they put a knife up to the sheep's neck, and they're going to sacrifice the sheep. And what they were doing was a ritual from these people's culture, the people who were the victims of this, and they were it was like a forgiveness ritual. So they're coming, Admiral McRaven shows up with some sheep after this family had been gunned down, and then they had blamed it on the family and then said it was Taliban, and that so that this scene is unfolding. This photographer, Jeremy Kelly, starts taking pictures of, he didn't know who he was at the time, of Admiral McRaven. And at the time, Admiral McRaven was the commander of the most elite, secretive U.S. military force. And he shows up with a sheep in Gardez, Afghanistan, and they're offering to sacrifice it. And the American and Afghan forces try to stop the photographer. They try to hit the camera away. They say that Starkey and Jeremy Kelly are not allowed in. But the family, and it was so smart of them, the family said, no, we want him here as a witness so that someone independent is here to know what goes on today. And so they have photos, and Starkey took in shorthand all the notes of what McRaven said in the room that day. And McRaven admitted to the head of this household that it was his forces that had killed these pregnant women and the Afghan police commander, and he apologized.
This was an event, a packed event at Harvard University in April 27th, when the book first launched, Jeremy Scahill's remarkable book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. The number to call is 516-620-3602 to become a member of WBAI, and you don't want to miss the book, and we're making it available to you. We urge you to call. We ask you to stand up for independent media. Make the call that makes the difference. Let us know that you're there. Let us know you're standing up for WBAI, and we will send you a copy of the DVD. We ask you to go to the phone and let us know you're there. Let us know you're standing up for WBAI. If you would like to get the double DVD, and let me tell you what's included in that DVD. It includes the speech that Jeremy Scahill gives at Harvard University before this discussion you just heard. Then the discussion with Noam Chomsky and Jeremy Scahill, as well as the show that we did when Jeremy first introduced Democracy Now, introduced Dirty Wars on Democracy Now. We had a two-day extended discussion. That's the second DVD. So you get the speech at Harvard, the discussion with Noam Chomsky and Jeremy Scahill, and then our extended two-day laying out in detail of Dirty Wars when Jeremy Scahill came on Democracy Now. The two DVD set is yours for a contribution of $100 if you call right now. 516-620-3602. If you'd like to get Jeremy's book, and it's a signed copy of the book, they're gold, folks, it's yours for $150. You know, Jeremy got his start on WBAI, on this station. That shows the power. We urge you to call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. A signed copy of Jeremy Scahill's book. You won't be able to put it down. You might want to because it's heavy. It's over, 700 pages. It's close to 700 pages. It's about 650, about 100 pages of footnotes to show the level of documentation. His research is unimpeachable. Jeremy's work is explosive. A signed copy of Dirty Wars is yours for $150. The double DVD of 2 days of Jeremy Scahill on Democracy Now! Laying out these investigations for the film and the book, Dirty Wars, following the consequences of the declaration that the world is a battlefield, declared so by the military, as Jeremy uncovers the most important foreign policy story of our time from Afghanistan to Yemen, Somalia, and beyond. Scahill reports from the front lines in this high-stakes investigation and explores the depths of America's global killing machine. He goes beneath the surface of these covert wars conducted in the shadows, outside the range of the press, without effective congressional oversight or public debate. And based on unprecedented access, Scahill tells the chilling story of an American citizen marked for assassination by his own government. He tells the story of Anwar al-Awlaki. He visited the Awlaki family a number of times in Yemen, along with Rick Rowley, the director of the film Dirty Wars. By the way, Jeremy's book, as his first book, Blackwater, has reframed the discussion in this country. Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army was his first book. And he changed the discussion about these mercenary forces throughout the world, primarily looking at Blackwater, so that it was Eric Prince who was on the defensive and who hasn't put out his biography in several years because Jeremy Scahill had changed the discussion. And then Jeremy focuses on this, the wars you do not see. I urge you, go to the phone right now and let us know you are in the House. Dirty Wars is the book, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. There are people calling in from all over. The book, a signed copy. Jeremy comes in. He has to sign hundreds of these books at a time. They are going like hotcakes. The book is called Dirty Wars. The world is a battlefield. We urge you to call in right now, drawn from the ranks of the Navy SEALs, Delta Force, former Blackwater, and other private security contractors, the CIA Special Activities Division, and JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, these elite soldiers operating worldwide with thousands of secret commandos working in more than 100 countries, funded through black budgets, special operations forces conducting missions in denied areas, engaging in targeted killing, snatching and grabbing individuals, and direct drone AC-130 and cruise missile strikes. While the Bush administration deployed these ghost militias, President Obama has expanded their operations and given them new scope and legitimacy. The book will change you. Dirty Wars, $150, a signed copy of the book, yours, that's $12.50 a month if you call in right now. $100, the double DVD, $200, the book and double DVD, 516-620-3602. Did I mention that you can also get it online at givetowbai.org, give number two, wbai.org, or just go to wbai.org. And I think you click under Public Affairs, you'll see Democracy Now!, all the gifts that we offer, and you can order right there. Please call. What counts is your call right now. And if you want to come to the set of Democracy Now! And watch the broadcast, you and your special guest, sit on the set, watch the broadcast, hang out with the Democracy Now! Team, with the guests who are in studio, and then I get to personally host you for dinner, and we break bread together, we toast WBAI, we kick back, I get to hear your stories, we become old friends fast. It is in a wonderful way to support WBAI. It's a $2,000 contribution, but mind you, it is tax deductible, it's a charitable contribution, and if you've done well and want to do good, think ahead. A gift you want to give someone, and you guys will come over for the show, and I'll host you for dinner or lunch, whatever you would like. Or you want to do it this week, or you don't have any idea when you're going to do it. You don't give the date to the person who answers right now. You just say dinner and a show. And then my wonderful colleague, Brenda Murat, will give you a call in the coming days, says, when do you want to do it? And you'll let her know. And you might say, I have no idea. I'll email you when I'm ready. And it might not be for a year. Or you might say, it has to be next week. We'll accommodate you. What counts is your call, and that $2,000 goes to keeping this independent nonprofit news organization alive. It is WBAI. We urge you to call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Make the call that makes it possible for WBAI to happen. If you want to pledge a $500 or $400 or $300 match to the transmitter, that would be great. Fund the transmitter fund, or $1,000, $2,000 for dinner and a show, $200 for Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, Jeremy Scahill's book and double DVD, yours for $200, the double DVD, $100, the book, $150 or $12.50 a month. Please call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Thank you so much for being there, for supporting WBAI in its time of need. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and we are asking you to go to the phone to become a member of WBAI. The number to call is 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Because we turn right now to a well-known economist. His name is Richard Wolff. He taught at University of Massachusetts Amherst for years, a professor, then came here to New York and teaches at the New School. We want to turn to a recent speech he gave. This is economist Richard Wolff delivering a speech entitled Cure for Capitalism at John Jay College in September.
I'm going to try to begin by telling you where we are in this economic crisis. Then I'm going to try to explain to you how and why it comes to be that the government of the United States, like governments in many other countries, has been so stunningly unsuccessful in bringing this disaster to an end. And then, in the most ambitious part of all, I'm going to try to suggest to you what the solution to this crisis will be, must be, should be. And it is not something that the government has done, but it is something I'm going to argue at the end the government should have taken the lead long ago in doing. As we speak right now, just so you understand, this crisis, which began in December of 2007, which makes it almost 5 years old now. And there's no end in sight. This crisis today is causing unbelievable havoc around the world. If you pick up your newspapers today or you watch television, you will probably see scenes in Madrid, Spain, and Athens, Greece, in which huge numbers of police are clashing with huge numbers of workers and students about what's going on there. Last week, 500,000 people in Portugal did the same. The richest province inside Spain, Catalonia, is probably going to secede from the country, dissolving it. We are talking about fundamental transformations and upsets about the same subject in those countries that I'm going to be dealing with the United States here today. All right, so let's begin with the crisis. Well, I've already told you how old it is. It's 5 years old. When it began in December of 2007, the number of unemployed people in the United States was estimated to be around 7 million. At the height of this crisis, a couple years ago, it reached 15 million, more than doubled. It went from 5% to 10% of the labor force. Today, it is 8.5%. What does that mean? It means we haven't come down even halfway from the worst point of this crisis. And indeed, in the last couple of months, unemployment has started to get worse again. The prediction for the next 12 to 18 months in this economy is for it to go down. Not only are we not having the recovery we were supposed to have, we're having the opposite. If you add up, as the government does, the number of people that are without work today and the number of people who have stopped looking but are without a job, and you finally add the number of people who have a part-time job but who want and need a full-time job, we're talking somewhere between 20 and 25 million of your and my fellow citizens. Wow. The Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, keeps an interesting statistic. It's called capacity utilization. Fancy words, simple idea. They measure what proportion of the tools, equipment, factory, office, store space is sitting empty, not being used, compared to what portion of our capacity to produce that is being used. And their estimate, a conservative estimate, is 20%, one-fifth of all the machines, factory space, office space, mall space, tools, equipment, typewriters, computers, positioned in a business are not being used. Well, what does that mean? It means that we have an economic system, our capitalist economic system, that cannot provide work for 20 to 25 million Americans who need it and want it. At the same time, one-fifth of the tools, equipment, and everything else those people would need to work with and work on is sitting, gathering rust and dust. If we put together as a nation the people who want to work with all the equipment and raw materials they need to do the work, we could produce a wealth of output that would transform our cities, solve our social problems, or at least make a really big dent in them. So we're all losers, not just those of us who don't have a job, but all of us who do not have the fruits of what those people and that unused equipment could produce. By any rational measure, an economic system that performs so badly ought long ago to have been questioned, debated, and in all likelihood, changed. But we haven't done that in the United States. For 50 years, the capitalist system was something we weren't supposed to question. And very few people did. If you check the congressional record, that's the record of all the statements made by all the congresspersons, all the senators, you will not find any sustained discussion for 50 years of capitalism in which those who thought it was good confronted those who thought it wasn't, where its strengths were put up against its weaknesses, so we could have a national debate about whether the economic system we have, capitalism, is the one we want to keep, given how it's performing. I always find this stunning, and I want you to do that too. We take pride in the United States that we question our educational system. We question the last couple of years our health system. We question such institutions as the family, marriage, heterosexuality, and so on. We ask a lot of questions about basic parts of our lives. We debate the different points of view. That's a good thing about this country. But when it comes to the capitalist system, no debate. We outdo one another in cheerleading. At best, that's a big fat immaturity. Our economic system deserves and needs criticism, just like all our other systems do. That's how a society progresses. It weighs the costs and benefits, the strengths and weaknesses of all of its systems, education, health, you name it. But for 50 years, no debate about capitalism. And guess what? If you don't debate and if you don't criticize the system, it rots. That's why you do it, to catch the flaws early, like diagnosing a disease. Catch it early and you can make the changes and they won't be so painful. That will get you over that problem. But if you don't allow criticism, if you act like people who criticize the economic system are either crazy or dangerous or disloyal or something like that, if you shut it down, then guess what? The system is free, without criticism, to go in whatever direction it wants. And you and I are now living through the results of all of that. A system that has spun out of control, that isn't delivering the goods to the American people, except for those at the top. But for the most of the rest of us, not so good. Some symptoms, besides those I've already mentioned. We are doing damage to a generation of college students. And by the way, I don't pick that example just because I'm here in a college. I use it everywhere I go. But we are doing something extraordinary. We are condemning a generation, yours, to be put in an impossible situation. There aren't jobs, as there ought to be. So many of you decide to go to college to improve your chances in a bad job market. Smart move, makes perfect sense. Meanwhile, we have allowed the cost of college to keep going crazy up. So the only way you can get the credential to get a job is by forking over money you and your family at this point have not the freedom to do. So guess what your generation is doing? You know, borrowing the money. Borrowing tens of thousands of dollars to get a degree, only to discover that the economic system that makes the price of education too high, that makes the financial resources of your family to afford that education too low, and then loads you up with debt, is going to show you when you're done that you may not get a job, and even if you do, the cost of paying off your accumulated debt is going to follow you and damage you and your life for years and years to come. That's not smart. That's making education a decision more and more people are not making. We as economists teach our students across America that the United States now has to compete in a world economy with the Europeans, with the Chinese, with everybody. And that one of the most important things we have to compete with is the educational attainment of our young people. That's what will shape, as much or more than anything else, the economic future of the United States. And what are we doing to prepare ourselves? We're making college too expensive. We're loading people up with debts. We're distracting them from study by the anxiety of debts they worry about and have to worry about. That's not smart. That's damaging your future opportunities as a way of coping with your current crisis. A system that makes people do that is a system that doesn't work real well. Let me turn then from the crisis we're in, and there are endless more examples of it that I can go through with you if you'd like later in the Q&A portion. But let me turn to what the government did and has done about this. Because when the capitalist system that we have breaks down, as it does over and over again, we usually call upon the government to save it. By the way, to save it from what? To save it from itself. The last time we had a crisis of this proportion was the 1930s. Started in 1929, it wasn't over until 1941. 11 or 12 years, depending on how you count. We're in year five. That one was worse than this one, at least so far, has gotten. And when that capitalist economic system that we're living in collapsed in the 1930s, unemployment, by the way, at its peak, 1933, 25% compared to 8.5% now, the government came in big time. Finally, that crisis was over in 1941. The next big doozy was the one that started in 2007. But in case any of you imagine that capitalism only has a problem every 30, 40 years, Between the end of the economic crisis of the Great Depression, 1941, and the beginning of the crisis we're in now, 2007, there were 11 other economic downturns. Capitalism is an extraordinarily unstable economic system. I like to drive that point home by saying the following. If you lived in an apartment with a roommate as unstable as this economic system, you would have moved out long ago or demanded that your roommate get professional help. But since when did you live in a capitalist system that's just as unstable and asked yourself the same question? Every president since the one in the 1930s, his name was Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Every president since then has been a president when the economic system goes down. Sometimes it only goes down for a few months. Sometimes, like this one, for years. Every president has done the following. He has said, if you do my policies, what I propose, not only will it get us out of this crisis, but it'll make sure that no future crisis creates problems for our children. Every president promised it. No president has yet delivered on that promise. That's why we have a crisis now. Because this system doesn't know how, has not been able to solve this crisis, these kinds of crises. And they sure as hell have not been able to prevent them. That's a reason to criticize a system that is working in this manner. Well, what did the government do this time? And what can we say about it? Well, the first thing to say about it is it hasn't worked. When this crisis first began to bubble up in 2007, the president at that time, George Bush, promised us in repeated statements, nothing to worry about, it'll be a downturn, it won't last very long. 6 months later, he said, nothing to worry about, it just affects the housing market, the subprime mortgage market. And we all scrambled to learn, what's a subprime mortgage? And then Mr. Bush was ridden out of office by the American people freaked out by this crisis, who brought in a new president, Obama. And he began by saying, well, we'll get our way through this. I'm the president who's going to fix all this. But here we are, 4 years later, hadn't happened. Now, the last thing on earth George Bush wanted at the end of his presidency was an economic crisis, because that's a guaranteed way to lose an election. He did everything he could. He used every economist he had to try to prevent that from happening. He couldn't do it. The government doesn't have the weapons at its disposal, the policies, to solve the problem. At least none of the things they tried worked. The last thing on earth Barack Obama wanted was to run for re-election, as he's doing now, at a time when that economic crisis he promised to solve would stare everybody in the face unsolved. He didn't want that. He used all of his advisors to do everything he thought was appropriate to prevent that from happening. Wrong again. And now Mr. Obama risks being run out of office by the same crisis that brought him in. What's going on here? Well, let's see. What did the government do? The government decided, first under Mr. Bush, and then under Mr. Obama, because they had the same policies, Obama just did them bigger, to throw huge amounts of money at the nation's biggest banks. And after that, huge amounts of money at some of the largest corporations in America. General Motors, our biggest car company. AIG Corporation, our biggest insurance company, and a whole host of others. The government responded to the crisis by bailing out the failed, bankrupt banks of the United States and many of the largest corporations. Here was the idea. If the government helps them at the top, well, they'll get going again, they'll be healthy as corporations, and the benefits of their profits and of their being healthy will trickle down to everybody else. They will hire people again, overcoming unemployment. They will spend money again, getting our economy going. That was the idea. By the way, that has a name, that idea. It's called trickle-down economics. You help the top, and you hope it trickles down to everybody else. Well, here's what the results of the Obama-Bush policies have been. Have you helped the big banks? Yes. Did you get them over the crisis? Yes. Did you help the big insurance company? Yes. Did you help General Motors? Yes. Their balance sheets look much better than they did in 2008 and 2009. But did the benefits to the top trickle down? No. No. Give you just one statistic. It is now reported by economists that corporations in America are sitting on $2 trillion, that's with a T, $2 trillion of cash. They're not investing that money. They're not hiring workers. They're not expanding production. Why not? Their answer is, we are responsible businessmen and women. We're not going to invest money when the economy looks as crappy as it does. We can't even sell the stuff we're making now. Why in the world should we make more? We can't sell it. So we're just going to sit on the money. Meanwhile, of course, if they sit on the money, then there are no jobs. Then there's no end to unemployment. Here's the irony. Because they don't invest the money they have, masses of people don't get that money. And because they don't get that money, they can't spend the money. And because the mass of people can't spend the money, the businesses say we can't invest it. This is called a vicious cycle. This is an economic system that isn't working. The government only helped the top 5 or 10%. Everybody else, you, are not helped. You weren't bailed out. But here's not where the story stops. It takes another step. How did the government get a lot of the money it used to bail out the banks, the corporations, and so on? The way the government gets that money in our society is not by taxing people or taxing companies. You could do that if the government taxed the money to stimulate our economy, then the government wouldn't run into debt and there wouldn't be a deficit because it would raise the money in taxes. It chose not to do that. And by the way, let me make clear why. Because you would have had a revolution in the United States. You cannot subject the American people to a massive unemployment, to the spectacle of bailing out only the people at the top, and then say, now you get to pay a ton of taxes to cover all of this. Then we would have in the United States exactly what's going on in Madrid and Lisbon and Athens now. So the government didn't do that. Here's what the government did to bail out the banks, General Motors, AIG, all the rest of it. They borrowed money. The government borrowed the money. Let me say that one more time. The government borrowed the money to bail out the top. And guess what? If the government suddenly starts to borrow huge amounts of money, which we did, like all other governments around the world, we're not unique, then the people who lend to the government, and who are they? Banks, large corporations, and wealthy individuals, and foreign countries will lend to the United States. When the government borrows, the lenders get nervous because they keep lending to a government. The government keeps borrowing more money. The lenders begin to get worried, you know, that government may not be able to pay us back. And you know why? Because when you borrow tons of money as a government, you got to pay interest on that. And you've got to pay it back, at least in part. And where is the United States, like every other government, where's it going to get the money to pay off all the lenders the interest and principal they have to pay now because they borrowed to bail out those at the top? Here's the answer, friends. And pay attention, because this is your life. The way the government gets that money is it promises to the lenders, the banks, the big corporations, the rich people, and the foreign governments. The U.S. government says, don't worry. We have the money to pay you back and pay the interest. You know how we're going to get that money? We're going to fire lots of public employees. We're going to cut back government programs. And we're going to use the money that we used to pay those workers' salaries and to pay for those programs. And instead, we're going to pay off the lenders from whom we borrowed the money to bail out the top in this period of crisis, so that all of you get to live in a country where all the leading politicians are discussing how much to cut, who to cut, when to cut, and among the cuts being considered, student loans, programs for old people, sick people. What an economic system. It breaks down repeatedly. It is in a doozy of a breakdown now. All its governments can think out of is trickle-down economics. Help the top, hope that it trickles down. Meanwhile, borrow the money to help the top, and then make the whole society pay for the money you borrowed to help the top. You wonder why people in Europe are in the streets. They wonder why you are not. Because it's the same process. And as soon as the election hoopla is over, you will be seeing on your daily newspaper all the signs of the cutbacks here that are called in Europe austerity. A way to pay for the crisis you didn't cause, for the bailout you didn't get, but you get to pay for it. And as long as you, the people of this country, permit it, it will continue. That's why those people in Europe are in the street, because they want their government to know they're not going to tolerate it. And where does that end? No one knows. But the political and economic turmoil in Europe is the worst and most profound that they've seen in half a century. And if you think the Atlantic Ocean is going to prevent that sort of thing from bubbling up here, you are very naive. Okay, so much for what's happening, and so much for a government that can't figure out what to do. Was it always this way? Before I give you the solution, I would like you to consider. And the answer is no. In the Great Depression of the 1930s, something very different happened. The crisis, as I've told you, was worse. A Democrat was elected president right in the middle, just like Obama was in the middle of this one. Franklin Roosevelt was elected in the middle of that one. But Franklin Roosevelt did not behave like Bush or like Obama. He behaved very differently. First, I'm going to tell you why, and then I'm going to show you what he did. Why did he behave differently? Did he come in like Obama to office? Yes, he did. In fact, many of his proposals and campaign statements sound a lot like Obama's. Check them out, 1932. You'll see. But he changed very fast once he was in. And what changed him? What changed him was the reaction of the American people to the Great Depression. Remember, it hit October 1929. He only comes into office, Mr. Roosevelt, in January of 1933. So it's already been going for several years. And the American people are angry. They're out of work in huge numbers. Their families are suffering. Their communities are suffering. If people are out of work, they don't pay taxes because they don't have an income, which means all the cities, towns, states, and federal government have no tax money coming in, so they have to cut all their social programs. You can understand what happened. You're living through a version of it now. But then Mr. Roosevelt discovered that the American people in the 1930s reacted in an organized way. Here becomes the difference from today. First organization, something called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. What was that? Well, it started out being the mine workers union in this country, led by a man named John L. Lewis. They decided that in the depths of a depression, as millions of Americans were losing their jobs, or if they held on to a job, it paid less, benefits were fewer, you know just what's happening now. He said, you know what American workers would do? They would join a union if they believed a union could protect them from what's being done to all the working people. So he decided to appeal to American workers to join unions. And here's what may come as a surprise to you. In a matter of months, tens of millions of Americans who had never been union members before joined unions. It was the most stunning unionization drive in American history, greater than anything that had ever happened before and greater than anything that has ever happened since. Within a year and a half, tens of millions of workers were organized in unions. And the unions went to the president and said, "We've got millions of members that are very dissatisfied with what's going on. You better do something." Unions and union workers had voted for Roosevelt. They got him into office that first time. There was another kind of organization that exploded in America at that time, too. This may surprise you even more. Socialist parties, several of them, and a communist party here in the United States grew very fast and had lots of influence and worked very closely with the CIO. They said that not only was the conditions of the mass of working people intolerable, but they said, we need system change. We need to get rid of capitalism because it's not working for most of us. We want socialism. And there were hundreds of thousands of these people, and they were well organized. They went to Roosevelt altogether, CIO, socialists, and communists. And they said to him, you better do something because what's building in America is a revolution. And in case you're wondering what kind, look over to that other country. It used to be called Russia. Now it's called the Soviet Union. Because if you think it can only happen there, think again. And Roosevelt got scared because Roosevelt could see what everybody could see then, that these were not idle terms. These were not idle boasts. These were real. So here's what Roosevelt did. And by the way, Roosevelt came from the 1%. Very old, wealthy family. His relatives had been president before him, Teddy Roosevelt, etc. So what did Franklin Roosevelt do? He got together his rich friends that he came from and the heads of the biggest American corporations, and he said to them, listen to me, gentlemen. Nowadays, he'd have to say gentlemen and ladies, but in those days, that hadn't happened yet. Just gentlemen. I'm going to tell you something you got to have to understand. We got two choices here, he says. We can stiff arm all of these angry workers, these socialists and communists. We can ignore their demands that we do something for the mass of the people in this country. But if we do, they are going to try to make a revolution here, and I'm not sure they won't pull it off. And you can't be sure either, he said, looking them right in the face. He says, I got a plan. You give me a lot of money, you corporations, you rich people. You give me a lot of money as president. I'm talking big money. And I'm going to use it to really help the mass of the American people. I'm going to go to those unions and those socialists and those communists, and I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to do something for the mass of people in this crisis. On one condition, you got to stop talking about this revolution stuff. No more of that. No more pointing at the Soviet Union. No more talking socialism, communism. Leave the capitalist businesses alone. Leave them alone, and I'll get you help for the mass of people. And he went to the rich ones in the corporation, and he said, the only way I can give help to the mass of the people suffering at a time when government has no money is if you give me your money. And if you don't, you're going to have a revolution, and then you're going to lose everything. So I advise you to take my deal. Half of them did. He split the corporations and the rich. Half of them bought what he said, and they gave him the money. I'm going to tell you in a minute how they did that. They gave him the money. And guess what Roosevelt did with the money from the rich? One, in the middle of the Depression, he created the Social Security system. We never had that before in America. He went on the radio, no TV then, he went on the radio and he said, every American who spent a lifetime working is 65 years of age or older, we, the government, are going to give these people money every month, a retirement, for the rest of their lives. Most of these people had no retirement. Their jobs didn't provide that. They hadn't the money to save for a retirement. He created a retirement. In that act, he took care of the old people of America on a massive scale, and he made sure that the old people weren't a burden on their kids, who, in a time of depression, couldn't help them. Second thing he did, he created the unemployment compensation system. Any of you who've ever been unemployed through no fault of your own, you know you can go to a certain place and you get a check for 6 months, a year and a half, every week, an unemployment check. Because it's not your fault that you're unemployed in most cases. He created that. And here's the big one he created. Beyond those two, beyond Social Security, beyond unemployment. He went on the radio and he said, if the private capitalist sector of America cannot provide jobs for the millions of Americans who want to work, who need to work, then there's no alternative but for me in the government to do it. And between 1934 and 1941, Roosevelt created and filled 12.5 million federal jobs. He gave hope, a job, income to millions of American families who thereby could make their mortgage payments and keep their home. Wow. At a time of depression, when there's no money, it turns out there is the money. And we know where the money was then, and that's where the money is now. It's in the hands of corporations and the rich. Roosevelt went and he got it. He used it to pay for Social Security, unemployment insurance, and federal jobs. Wow. And here's how it worked. Rich people in 1940s, 50s, and 60s, what was the income tax rate they had to pay the richest in America? Top income tax rate for rich people. Here's what it was. 91%. What does that mean? Every dollar over 25,000, with a lot of money in those days, every dollar over 25,000 you earned in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you had to give Uncle Sam 91 cents. You got to keep 9. You got it? What is it today? What is the top rate that the richest Americans pay today? Answer, 35%. Do you understand? The reason our government has no money is because over the last 50 years, the richest people in America have enjoyed a tax cut that drops what they pay from 91% to 35%. If you're not a rich person, you don't have, and you never got, nor did your parents, anything remotely like that. in 1945, for every dollar the federal government collected by income tax on people, it collected a dollar and a half in income tax from corporations. Today, for every dollar the federal government collects in income tax off individuals, it collects 25 cents from corporations. So what are the last 50 years? Taxes removed off of corporations onto people and off of the richest people onto all of you. So on behalf of America's corporations and wealthy people, I want to say to all of you, thank you. Very kind of you. Thank you for paying right through the nose for a government that could not save you from an economic crisis you didn't cause. Okay, so what's the problem here? The problem here is not that we don't have a CIO, a socialist, or a communist, although that would make things quite different. They have those things in Europe. What's the problem here? Well, let's go to the root of the problem. The problem are the corporations of America, the way we do business in America. Most business in America, most goods and services are produced in something called a corporation. And in the corporation, which does the business of America, here's how the decisions are made. Corporations are controlled by shareholders. You get one vote for every share you own in deciding what a corporation does. Not one vote per person, that's a democratic arrangement. One vote per share. So if you own 1 million shares, you get 1 million votes. If you own no shares, that's how many votes you get. Most of the workers in, and I could pick any corporation, I'll pick, say, IBM, just for illustration purposes. Most of the workers in IBM have few or no shares. They have, therefore, few or no votes. Most of you in this room have no shares of IBM, so you have no votes. Who has the votes? They're called major shareholders. Usually about a dozen people or institutions that own the block of the shares. So they have the bulk of the votes, and those votes entitle them to select the board of directors. That's the top group in any corporation, usually numbers between 15 and 20 people. They make all the decisions, all the decisions. Let me give you an example. They decide what the company produces. So, for example, the board of directors decided that certain of the old GM cars are not going to be produced anymore. Can't get an Oldsmobile. They don't make them anymore. Instead, they make other things. So the board of directors decide what a corporation produces. Number two, a board of directors decides how the production is carried out, with dangerous chemicals or not, in a well-lit room or not, with terrible noise or not. Do you get benefits for working there or not? They also decide everybody's salary and wages and benefits. Wow.
You've been listening to Richard Wolff, author of Capitalism Hits the Fan. His latest book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Cornel West calls it required reading. The speech he gave at John Jay College in September, we offer you the whole thing on DVD. You're listening on the radio, but we filmed it, and you get the full speech. I'm sorry we couldn't play it all for you, but you get it for a contribution of $75 by calling 516-620-3602. If you'd like to get his book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, the book is yours for $100. Put them together for $150 or $12.50 a month. We ask you to call. We ask you to stand up for independent media. The number to call is 516-620-3602. I wanted to bring you more of the speech, pitch less. Please support that kind of calculation by calling in right now. Get the book and DVD. Fantastic summer reading. Great to give to a library, perhaps a high school, a college, a public library, or a prison library. Go to your phone right now. Your call makes the difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. As simple as that, for Pacifica Radio to be here in the New York region. Your call counts. 516-620-3602. And I want to really thank a lot of people who have called in over these days and pledged your support. Fill the phone lines. Let us know you're there. If we raise enough money in this hour, we can go back to Richard Wolff. Just ask for the Wolff Pack. That's the Richard Wolff book and DVD. We urge you to call. Book and DVD, yours for $150 or $25, or not $25, $12.50 a month. If you can't do the $150 all at once, do $12.50. You can also pledge online at givetowbai.org, the two being the number two. If you live in Manhattan or you live in Newark, or you live in Queens, or you live in Staten Island, or you live in Long Island, Nassau, or Suffolk counties, if you live in Westchester or Rockland counties, we're asking you to go to the phone right now. If you live in Connecticut, I can only say your call matters so much to us right now. Please call in. If you live in Edison, New Jersey, or Plainfield, or Westfield, or Elizabeth, or Bayonne, or Union, or Cranford, or Cranberry, or Staten Island, anywhere, or you live in the Oranges, give us a call. Clifton, Montville. If you live in Montclair or Upper Montclair, we're asking you to go to the phone. Make the call that makes the difference. Democracy at Work, a cure for capitalism. Capitalism, the system spawning deepening economic crises alongside its bought and paid for political establishment. Richard Wolff writes, neither serves modern society's needs. He is compelling new manifesto, advocates an alternative based on workers themselves directing their workplaces. Democracy at Work shows why and how to make democratic workplaces real. It speaks to those who realize that capitalist economics and politics as usual have become intolerable and who seek a concrete action program. The New York Times Magazine talks about Richard Wolff. Noam Chomsky says ideas of economic democracy are very much in the air, as they should be, with increasing urgency in the midst of today's serious crises. Richard Wolff's constructive and innovative ideas suggest new and promising foundations for much more authentic democracy and sustainable and equitable development, ideas that can be implemented directly and carried forward, a very valuable contribution in troubled times, says Chomsky. Cornel West says Richard Wolff is a leading socialist economist in the country. This book is required reading for anyone concerned about a fundamental transformation of the ailing capitalist economy. We urge you to call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Give us a call. Let us know you are in the house. You know, Richard Wolff just has a remarkable way of laying out in lay terms, you know, these macro terms, the contours of the present crisis of U.S. capitalism, but doing it in a clear, concise way, avoiding use of jargon. Anyone can understand this. Even if you have a block against economics, you can understand Richard Wolff. He really lays things out. The book is yours for $100. The DVD, $75. Go to your phone right now, $12.50 or $150 altogether, or $12.50 a month. Make the call that makes WBAI happen. Have I mentioned New Rochelle or Yonkers or anywhere in the Bronx or Upper Manhattan or Manhattan? Washington Heights, Inwood, we're asking you to call. If you live anywhere in Harlem, East or West, or you live in the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side, or you live in Hell's Kitchen or Chelsea or Clinton or the West Village or the Middle Village or the East Village or Alphabet City or over there in Williamsburg, we're asking you to give us a call. Let us know you're in the house. If you live in Fort Greene or you live in Fort Dix, we're asking you to call in right now. That number again, 516-620-3602. Maybe you live in Port Jeff or Port Washington or Huntington or Roslyn Heights or Great Neck or Little Neck or Hempstead or Amityville or Freeport or Copaig or Hopog or Quag. We need your support. Babylon, we're asking you, Brentwood, Bayshore, to give us a call, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Make the call that makes WBAI happen. It's as simple as that. In Connecticut, just because I haven't mentioned you yet, doesn't mean that you shouldn't call in. You are not off the hook till you take it off the hook. Red Hook will let you know about that. And Greenpoint, give us a call. Blue Point, we're asking you to call in right now. If you live in Oakdale, Long Island, give us a call. 516-620-3602. If you live in Greenwich or Stamford or Darien or Springdale or New Canaan or Norwalk or Westport or Fairfield or Bridgeport or along the Connecticut River, anywhere, we're asking you to go to the phone right now. Yep, we cannot do this without you. Maybe you live in Hamden or New Haven, Milford, Bridgeport. You let us know how WBAI, how far out it goes when you call. The book is yours for $100, the DVD for $75. Put them together for $150 or $12.50 a month. And if you want to come to the set of Democracy Now! And watch the broadcast, what a difference it makes to WBAI. Dinner and a show. I'm talking about dinner and show because, well, I'm doing it tonight. So it's very much on my mind, and I'm so looking forward to it. I've done it hundreds of times, and I would love to do it with you and your special guest, whoever you'd like to bring. So this is when listeners come to the set of Democracy Now!, and this could be you. You watch the broadcast, bring a special guest, maybe your partner or a daughter, a son, a friend, whoever you'd like to bring. You meet the guests who are in studio, the amazing guests, Eduardo Galeano, Isabel Allende, Jeremy Scahill, Danny Glover. We urge you to call in. Whoever it is who is here, you get to meet. And if they've written a book, you get them to sign your book. You hang out with them. Sometimes they stay for an hour. It's crazy. We have a great time. Oh, you have coffee and tea with us in the morning. And then the team that makes Democracy Now! Happen, the band of magicians who make it all happen, who are running around quite frantically in the morning, and you see it all go down. It may appear to you calm as you listen to Democracy Now! You see the craziness when you come in here in the morning. We ask you to go to the phone. The number to call is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Make the call that makes a difference. So dinner and a show is what you could ask for, where you come to the set of Democracy Now!, you watch the broadcast, you meet the team that makes Democracy Now! Happen, you meet the guests in studio, you're sitting right on the set drinking Democracy Now! In with fair trade organic coffee, muffins, bagels, they're the best in town. And then I personally get to host you and your special guest for dinner. Maybe you got a birthday, a graduation, an anniversary, a holiday on the horizon that you want to just do right. I would look forward to singing you happy birthday, or your partner happy anniversary, or whoever happy graduation. Is there a happy graduation song? Or just telling you you're a jolly good fellow or sister. We urge you to go to the phone. So if you'd like dinner and show, the show being Democracy Now!, dinner, we kick back, break bread together, toast WBAI. I get to hear your stories and we become old friends fast. That is yours for a contribution of $2,000. I know that's a lot. But if you could possibly afford it, if you've done well and want to do good, you're keeping this University of the Airwaves open for everyone, open admissions for all. Keep the phone calls coming in. Go to your phone right now. If you live in Hollis, Queens, or in Hoboken, we're asking you to call in. If you live in Hell's Kitchen or Hempstead, Long Island, make the call that makes the difference. If you live in Holtsville, Long Island, give a call right now. Manhasset, Center Reach, we need your support. We ask you to reach, help WBAI. Reach even further than its grasp, reaching always for the impossible, and that impossible then maybe becomes possible because you were there for WBAI. We ask you to call in right now. We ask you to stand up for independent media. We definitely cannot do this without you. If you come from the historic area of Peekskill, give us a call, or Mohegan Lake, or perhaps you live in, Yorktown Heights, or maybe in Mount Kisco. Make the call that makes the difference. We cannot do this without you, only with you. Make the call now. So, by the way, on that dinner and a show for that $2,000 contribution, you don't have to know when you can do it. Just call. Just say, I want to make this call. If you appreciated today's broadcast, as we talked about the influence of money in broadcasting, in politics, it really matters that you call. We have to be able to talk about these issues. We're not brought to you by corporations that profit from war. We're not brought to you by, when we talk about healthcare, we're not brought to you by the insurance industry or big pharma. You know, when we talk about climate change, we're not brought to you by the oil, the gas, the coal companies. We're brought to you by listeners like you who are deeply concerned about independent media. Please call in. Please let us know that you are there. The number to call is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Maybe you would like to call in. Maybe you live.
All righty then. Well, that's always great to hear from Amy Goodman. She's all over the place now, Democracy Now!, and we're always glad to have her back here at WBAI. I've always considered her the spokesperson for WBAI. I really like what she talks about, and continuously and consistent. All righty then. So what we have now, it's 8 o'clock, and you know what that means. Yep.
You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, also streaming on the web at WBAI.org, also streaming on the web at PCRadioshow.org.
And today is August the 7th, 2013.
And this is the Personal Computer Show.
And good evening, one and all. This is Joe King. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Hank Key is with me tonight on my right. Stevie Deeby is on my left. And David Perry is out in California enjoying the sun, enjoying the mojitos, and not on the radio because I wouldn't let him come. We're having a special guest tonight. Before we go to the guest and have Hank tell us about her, I do want to point out that we are still in our summer membership drive. And if you want to, while you're listening to us, you can go to on your computer to give2wbai.org, or you can call 516-620-3602. And we'll talk more about that later. Hank, who is our guest tonight?
Well, before we get to our guest, and I want to get to that as soon as I can, but just to let everyone know that today we are starting our 31st year, just, you know, the Personal Computer Show. Well, we have one clap and one with asthma. No, seriously, we started on August the 6th in 1983. And it's been a long gig, Joe. You, myself, and then we had David Burstein as one of the original members. That was a really long time ago, and it's a lot of shows.
We had Ross Greenberg was a regular. Yeah. Alfred Poor was a regular.
We had Horvath.
Michael Horowitz. Oh, Michael is still active as our webmaster, but he was on the air for a number of years. Stevie DB, of course, makes up for all of that and then some.
And we had Joanne Witt.
We did mention David Perry, of course.
But in the 30 years' time, I guess one reason why we survive is because we are really very consumer-oriented and try not to get into the minutia of politics here.
Well, that's part of it, and the rest of it is that we're just too stubborn to die.
Well, listen, we do have a special guest, and her name is Amanda Del Basso. Amanda, did I pronounce it correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
And who is Amanda Del Basso?
Well, she works for Google, and I was introduced to her by a fellow club member, and Irene said to me, you have to speak to her. She is quite a young lady. And she represents Google.
Wait a minute. I have to interrupt. I'm sorry, all of you. When Irene says she's quite a young lady, Irene is 93 years old. Every woman is a young lady to Irene.
Amanda, can you tell me how you met Irene?
Yes, I can. And so you mentioned I work at Google, and my primary role there is as what we call digital online sales account executive. So that means that I work with people who advertise on Google to basically figure out their advertising goals and then turn them into a reality. But I actually met Irene doing a side project, if you will, that was at Oats, which is in Chelsea, a nonprofit that we worked with there. And we were doing a program that I like to call Using Google Tools for Good. And this particular program was all about teaching seniors in the Chelsea area how to use Gmail. So I met Irene there as we were learning a little bit more about some of the advanced Gmail features that she wanted to master.
What Google tools were you demonstrating to them?
So in that session, we were particularly focusing on Gmail. So we were doing everything from signing people up for a Gmail account if they didn't have one already, to doing things like teaching people how to initiate a video chat, which Google calls Hangouts, so that they could, you know, maybe do something like video chat with their grandkid who was at school. So in that session, again, all about Gmail, pretty focused there. The session that I'm actually doing tomorrow at the New York Amateur Computer Club is going to cover Gmail, but a couple of other topics as well.
Oh, okay. Let me just announce that you will be making a presentation at NYU. And we'll make the announcement at the half hour, but it's room number 520 at NYU, the Silver Center building. And your talk is how Google tools can help you communicate and organize. Now, when you were dealing with these seniors, was it something like it took hours, or really they just latch onto it very quickly?
You know, I have to say it happens pretty fast, and really I'm pretty passionate about trying to work with, we call them our students. It's probably been a while since some of these guys have been students, but we're happy to have them back in the classroom, if you will. And I call it really looking for the hook. So when we sit down, we have the Googlers who are volunteers who work with the seniors really try to figure out what makes them tick and what aspect of using the computer or Google or technology could really open their eyes and really help them. And so that's kind of why I like the title that we have tomorrow, which is about communicating and organizing, because those are two really common themes that we see. People want to be able to, you know, get photos from maybe their kids who live in a different state, or, you know, be able to remember the name of the restaurant they're going to and have that pop up on their phone, which we can do via Google Calendar, you know, when they're out and about. So I'm excited to kind of deliver that material. But I have to say, once they learn one product, it seems like they like to learn all the other ones, because they understand the utility of it.
When you do this, how big a group is it that you work with?
You know, it really varies. What's great about Google is, you know, I mentioned that this is sort of a quote-unquote side project, but Google is a place where your employees are really encouraged to go out and do things that they're passionate about. So that can be projects like this. People do all sorts of different things. And we're really flexible about the programming. So, you know, Google's offices are right here in Chelsea, and that was really why we originally wanted to work with an organization in Chelsea. And the groups, we've done it a couple times, has been anywhere from, say, 12 to 20 students per class. And in the example that I met Irene, those classes were like 2 hours. So we probably did about 15 minutes of chatting about that hook, and then the rest of the time was really mastering the different skills that the Googlers and their students were wanting to move forward with.
Well, you know, in New York City and the metropolitan area, we have a lot of senior citizens. And if these groups were interested in something like this, was this a one-shot thing you did, or is this something that that Google is open to doing for other senior groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're working on what we call scaling the program right now. And I actually only moved to the New York Google office recently. I was in Boston before then. So we're still trying to kind of get everything up and running, but our goal is certainly to continue to expand, and not only really to work with, you know, senior groups, but with all sorts of different groups. And what's great is, you know, I work with a ton of people who, you know, have more of a focus on all these different areas. So we have a great program called Get Your Business Online, where Google actually brings in small businesses and, you know, shows them how to use not only Google tools, but we have different resources that can even help a small business, you know, do something like create a website. And if people wanted to get more information about that particular program, this sounds cheesy, but you can always Google it, if you will, and just search for Get Your Business Online, and they'll be able to get information about those resources.
Now, I'm sure that Google works with, people of all ages. Have you found that working with seniors, it's a different kind of a challenge, because it's a different mindset or different culture that they were raised in?
I think it's definitely different than working with, you know, my 7-year-old cousin who picks up my iPad and knows exactly what to do without batting an eye, and even teaches me things half the time. But I think in a way it's almost more rewarding, if you will. And for me, it's really just because of the impact that could have. So, you know, being able to connect someone online to, you know, a family member, a friend that they maybe haven't seen or been able to talk to in that kind of way, because, you know, they just aren't familiar with that tools, I think provides, you know, huge value. And, you know, we try to make things pretty practical. So that's kind of like what I'll do in my presentation tomorrow. I talk a little bit about Gmail, but then I try to really dive into, like, practical tips and examples. So I talk, you know, about like my day and how I'm a big fan of to-do lists. And before I really became a Google Power user, if you will, I was like always writing things down on these pieces of paper that I would stick in my pocket. And by the time I got to CVS or the grocery store, wherever I was going, the piece of paper would be gone. There goes my to-do list, and I kind of have to start all over. So I talk about using this feature within Gmail that's called Tasks, where you can make that to-do list. You can have it on your phone. It's really easy. You get there. You still have all your information when you're at CVS or the grocery store. And it's just little things like that that can really make life easier. And that's, you know, that's certainly appealing to seniors, but I think it's also appealing to everyone, which is, you know, part of why the Google tools are so great.
Now, you're talking about making it like easier for people, but I know that when I go on a website and I go into google.com, you know, the question I ask is, where do I find these tools?
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, so many places.
But there's no one button I go to that say it's all there in one folder or one page.
Yep. No, I think that's definitely, and we have so much, you know, people are sometimes like, where do I start? So my advice is always to think about what you want to do. And for me, again, that always goes back to the communication and the organization. And the one site that's great for that is actually the Google Apps site. Google Apps is what we call kind of the suite of products that is Gmail and Docs, which we now call Drive, Calendar, all like the utility type tools.
Excuse me, let me ask you, what's a URL for that?
It's learn.googleapps.com.
Okay, it's all one word.
It has some dots in between, but yeah.
Okay, you so want to repeat? Tell you what, why don't you repeat it again?
Sure. It's learn, period, or dot, Google Apps, and then .com at the end.
Now, I know that our listening audience has people of all ages, but I don't want someone to say, I went there, now